Yeah, good afternoon. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We are very pleased to welcome you to a new edition of our PwC Transfer Pricing podcast. Today, we would like to inform you on the very latest developments on Pillar 1 and Pillar 2. It seems like years ago when we discussed this in this round, in this podcast series, around about 7 months ago, early December. And we discussed and we promised once we hear back from the inclusive framework what they've decided, we will come back and provide you with additional input. In the meantime, I think we have all had to learn to live with COVID-19. Everything has changed. And obviously, the agenda has a little bit changed. And for quite a while, it seemed like Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 and the OECD efforts on all of this seemed quite far away. But in the last weeks, I would say everything came up and we are, I would say, back on track in dealing with that. We had some particular developments from the US, which we would like to discuss, which we would like to share with you. And if I say we are together again in the same group as in early December 2019. It is Isabel Fallin and Giorgio Maffini.
Thank you, Stefan. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time it is when you're listening to this podcast. My name is Isabel Verlinden and I'm PwC's Global Transfer Pricing Leader. Happy to be here.
And I'm Giorgia Maffini and I work for the Transfer Pricing and the Tax Policy team in our UK London office. And before joining PwC about 2 years ago, I was working for the OECD.
Great. So we have the same team as mentioned as in December. Well, I've already mentioned we have seen quite some developments over the last couple of weeks. Before that, end of last year in the fourth quarter of 2019, when we had the OECD hearing in Paris in November and December, that it seemed quite clear Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 will come across. It will take some time. It will take some technical discussion, but obviously, it will come across. And nowadays, with what we see due to the COVID-19 crisis, obviously we have a scenario where countries will have some kind of, let me call it, appetite for new taxes, or at least to gather taxes in order to come up or to deal with the country deficits we're seeing. And that is what we're expecting here, that taxes will rise. And if you look at the situation and if you look at what economists are saying, that is the obvious situation we're talking about. In trying to see where we start or where we are in all of this, it seems like that the relevance of the OECD work is in question. Let me put it like this. The US has suggested to pause regarding the Pillar 1 amount A work, or let me call the Pillar 1 discussion. And Isabel, if I may, I would like to drop out the first question to you. How do you see that? What is your impression? What do you think? What is going to happen with the OECD work? Will it leave, or will the relevance of the OECD work be decreasing, or is it the same as before? What is your expectation?
Thank you, Stefan. So first of all, there is no new material on television these days in the holiday period, while the OECD work is still going on. So if you want to have a bit of suspense, a bit of action, you have to follow what's going on. So the fact that the US have said we're going to pause the work on Pillar 1 doesn't mean that the work has been suspended whatsoever. Just as a small recap, OECD Pillar 1 is about the recalibration of taxing rights with the amount A, B, and C. As you probably know, Pillar 2 is about a global anti-base erosion proposal, so introducing basically a minimum corporate taxation. Well, when the US said that they wanted to pause the work on Pillar 1 mid-June, that created a bit of a sentiment like, should we pursue the work? Should we pursue providing input to the OECD? Well, the answer is definitely yes, because the G20 has given a firm mandate to the OECD to continue the work. And it's more than just giving that firm mandate to the OECD. It has high expectations. So there is the political willingness and the clear expectation to move on. And the expectation is that for the upcoming inclusive framework meeting, 8 and 9 October, and inclusive framework meeting, meaning those 137 countries, well, blueprints will need to be presented at that meeting in October on both Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 blueprints. What does it mean? It goes beyond a sort of a high-level outline of an architecture. It's not yet that much of saying there will be an agreement, but progress will need to be made between now and October. So this is pretty serious. And the US asked for a delay on Pillar 1 because they feared that there was too much a focus on the residual profit of predominantly US technology companies that risk to be chopped off in the direction of market jurisdictions. On the other hand, the US was saying that they would be committed to pursue the work on Pillar 2. And that they wouldn't see too much reasons to suspend that work. So that on Pillar 2, the minimum tax, there would be no reason to pause work on that whatsoever. Just as a final remark on US Pillar 1 interpretation, as you might know, they see this as a kind of a safe harbor. So companies can decide to opt in or not to opt in. I would like to hand over in a second to Georgia, but maybe mentioning one of the political questions that's still open. There are questions on the scope and the quantum. So that needs to be decided on Pillar 1, and this is the work that needs to be addressed now. On the technical side, we're going to see that a lot of the focus will be on a qualitative approach, starting from the connection to the market, because it's basically about an amount A determination. So how can I see how to best define and quantify the sort of location-specific economic rent that consumers or users are creating. So maybe, Georgia, a good moment for you to chip in on amount B and amount C, because I was only limiting myself to amount A at present.
Thank you, Isabel. Yes, so amount B is the additional part of Pillar 2. So it's the fixed return, just to remind ourselves, that we should give to an entity performing basic marketing and distribution functions, you know, to be defined, of course, what these basic marketing and distribution functions are. I think that the main question around amount B now is whether this is really still a key point for the negotiation. And I'm not sure about that. Yesterday in the webcast, Grace Perez Navarro, who is the deputy director of the tax department of the OECD, was very clear that amount B is not related to the digital issues, but was included in Pillar 1 as an attempt to simplify some part of the current system. So it seemed to me that probably now that really the OECD and the member countries are working toward an agreement, maybe there is a bit less of an interest in amount B. But, so what are generally the positions within the inclusive framework with respect to this fixed return for what we understand is a limited risk distributor? Amount B as a feature is something that developing countries has thought could be helpful. For example, the African Tax Administration Forum has been quite public about that in the last couple of months. But because the amount B would be able to bring a certain amount of revenues to some developing countries that do not have, you know, the expertise, the resources to apply the arm's length principle. On the other side, though, it's difficult to understand why capital exporting countries like, for example, Germany and countries that have the ability to operate the arm's length principle correctly should agree on a fixed return without safeguards for their own multinationals. I don't think it's very, so just a pure amount be a pure fixed return without anything else around that that could give certainty to multinational is probably not incentive compatible. And hence, it's difficult to see how, say, the G7 countries, the capital exporting countries, would agree on that. So still, I think the negotiation around amount B is still very open. There have been OECD officials have talked about a pilot project around amount B, but this did not came up on the webcast yesterday. And just to conclude, there are a lot of technical issues around amount B for those of us who are working with the current transfer pricing system. So the first question that for me is a very important one is how sustainable is it that amount B, a fixed return, remains within the arm's length principle? Even if we start with an amount B that is benchmark for, say, the first 2 or 3 years, since amount B is formulaic and levied at destination, there will be pressures for this fixed return to increase. So I think this risk is very high. And also, you know, and this year we go back to many of the issues that we have discussed in transfer pricing during the COVID crisis. A fixed return that is fixed always without flexibility means that we have to give a fixed return in the market across all economic outcomes. So whether we have a loss or not, whether the group is doing well or not. And then the question, as many of us have debated, how is this at arm's length? Okay, so, but this is really what we are battling also with in the context of the COVID-19. This is probably an issue far from being resolved. But the problem is that if we institutionalize amount B as a fixed return without any flexibility, there is no going back from that, even if we are in an economic crisis, I think. So lots of uncertainty around amount B, but also a lot of technical issues for transfer pricing funds.
Maybe, Stefan, a final note on Pillar 1 and amount A in particular on the determination. So we are expecting materials that will come out from the OECD. And there will be a sort of a two-stage decision-making panel approach in order to make sure that one agrees on what we're talking about. So what basis for allocation of a part of the residual profit will be taken. So, and that two-stage decision-making panel process will be inspired by the ICAP program, so the International Compliance Assurance Program, a sort of a multilateral tax risk assessment program. So on this one, back to you, Stefan.
Yeah. Thank you, Isabel and Georgia. That is really helpful. Though I have some troubles. I try to be honest. I have some trouble to see how we can bring this decision panel process, this two-stage decision panel process, how we can bring this in. I do understand ICAP, and I do understand that there is a kind of linkage. But looking at Germany and the experience we have made with ICAP, we had some, or the German tax authorities had some problems in getting into ICAP in the first round, and they've decided for the second part, okay, we are getting into that, but we do not have made that quite of an experience. But I know it's a side discussion, but let's wait and see how this all comes up, but it will not be an easy one. Georgia, I know I will ask now a question which you won't like, but can you give us kind of outlook from your perspective? What about the unilateral actions in terms of the digital service taxes? We have some that are enacted already. We have some that are proposed. We know all about the tensions from a tax political perspective. But what is your perspective on this? How will this all develop? Will countries go ahead, and will the EU make another development if the OECD is not able to come up with something by end of the year?
Thank you, Stefan. And maybe I'll take 1 second to explain why I don't like the digital turnover taxes, digital services taxes, and unilateral, which are the currently popular unilateral measures, are turnover taxes. But I don't like them because I'm an economist, and more than 40 years ago, two Nobel Prizes in economics have shown how turnover taxes are the most distortive taxes that you can use in the tax system. So I'm naturally not very happy with them. But maybe, so also the world of unilateral actions is very complex, not only because we have digital services taxes, but we have diverted profit taxes and many other measures that have been labeled as anti-avoidance measures, but in fact have a lot to do with digital taxation. But it's maybe useful to focus on 3 points that I take really from the work we do with clients on the UK digital services tax. And some of the work we do is actually with German clients, with German multinationals. The first point to say is that the legislation of a digital services tax needs to define the scope of the tax, because the tax is not a broad tax, but is ring-fenced to some digital players. So the legislation tries to legislate to describe a very innovative business model that is heterogeneous across different companies. So the legislation cannot be precise. It will never be precise. What does this mean for our clients? It means that they often don't know whether they are in scope or not, unless, you know, they are some specific, very famous name. In other cases, for many of our clients, it's unclear whether they are in scope or not and which part of their activity is in scope. So, and you need to invest to understand that. The second point is that for some clients, it's very challenging to collect and classify all the data that you need to calculate the DST base. And we have heard of cases where the tax department had to involve engineers. Okay. And so as you can imagine that when you have to involve engineers, it becomes really a very expensive exercise, especially thinking that DSTs are all different across the world. So the UK DST is different from the French one, which is different from the Italian one, which is different from other DSTs. So really a lot of complexity and a lot of uncertainty around DSTs, on top of the fact that they are, by construction, very distortive because they are gross taxes. Third point to conclude is probably more of a broad picture point, is that we got rid of DSTs, of not DSTs, of turnover taxes in the EU when we introduced VAT a very long time ago. And seeing them coming back is worrying, because they can easily be adopted and expanded to other sectors. There is no reason why they have to stick to the tech sector from the political point of view. So my fear is that they can really be expanded rather easily. And in this case, we would really go back 50 years in terms of efficiency of the tax system.
Yeah, that's very clear. And I think every company, every taxpayer will agree to what you've just outlined, Georgia. I have another question for the two of you. I think if you now look at coming up, what we see at year end, or maybe early next year, or whenever it will take place, but at some point of time, it will occur. What is the best way to deal with Pillar 1 and Pillar 2? But obviously, when I talk to companies, to taxpayers, they are all telling me, we do understand there is something coming up, and we have to deal with it in the real world. It will be there at some point of time. We do not know how it will look like, but at least we know there will be something. And what I understand, companies are trying to prepare. Do we have any idea, or do we have any suggestion what companies can do right now in order to do this kind of preparation?
I'm happy to take that question, Stefan. So first of all, you could get panic-stricken and say, I'm doing nothing at all because it's too complicated and we don't know what's going to happen. And you wouldn't be the only one if you would take that as a way forward. We even hear that from some of the country representatives at the OECD in Working Party 6. But unfortunately, that's not a course of action that we would suggest to do. You have to think about the impact, and there are some ways to model that. And I'm not saying that you should immediately jump on all these PwC tools that we have available, but there might be some good stuff in there. So trying to see what the likely impact is. So for instance, you have quite some domestic-to-domestic trade. Do the impact assessment. You might be suffering losses. You might be thinking of what about my pre-regime losses? What about carry forward? These are all open technical questions the OECD is still working on. So we can help you with the impact assessment. And the OECD, if you wish so, is very open to listen to that and takes these suggestions and concerns very seriously on board. So the standstill is probably not an action. That's one thing you can do. The other thing that might be interesting is Grace Perez Navarro, to whom Georgia was already referring, was also very empathic with the current pandemic and what effect this could have in terms of system profits, value creation within a company. Well, you can also think of your transfer pricing compliance today and see whether there aren't good supporting reasons for already revisiting your system profit allocation internally. So I'm staying away for a second from the OECD Pillar 1 and Pillar 2. But for instance, you take global market indicators, so macroeconomic indicators like GDP or PMI, which stands for Purchasing Managers Index, giving some prevailing trends in manufacturing. Well, these sorts of macroeconomic indicators can be a good basis to see whether you can't rework even your benchmarks during the year and make already mid-year adjustments, because you might be facing a hit in your system profit. The third thing is third-party behavior. As transfer pricing at the end of the day is about benchmarking and looking at what open market conditions are dictating, so mimicking what's happening in the open market, well, there is quite some useful material readily available on what third parties are doing in their contractual allocations, royalty agreements, rental agreements, lease agreements, and the like. We have a pretty good inventory of all that. And the last one, Stefan, before heading back to you, is the unilateral measures taken. Georgia was already discussing that at length. We have a very good tracker of unilateral systems, what they are capturing, how they are calculating the taxes due. And that goes from the UK with their 2% to up to Chile with their 19%. So back to you, Stefan.
Mm. Yeah, thank you, Isabel. I think it's only fair to say, even if we do not know what is coming out of Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, and in considering what you've just outlined, looking at the situation we are facing with COVID-19, that we have to rework maybe on the benchmarking and all that stuff, it seems like a good idea to start it right now. Even to be prepared, that is what I'm hearing from clients and companies who are interested in looking at this and making up their mind. It seems like it is not too early to start thinking about it, to work on it, even if we do not know the perfect outcome out of the OECD developments. But at least there are some routes that obviously they're going to follow, and we will see some actions there. So that is helpful. Before wrapping up, maybe, Georgia, if I may ask you one additional question on the way forward, let me put it like this. If I may confront you with a citation from Pascal Saint-Amer from yesterday, I think we're in the OCD Webcast took place on Wednesday, 22nd of July. If I got it correctly, he said, we do not technically know what type of an agreement will be reached in October. The G20 said, we are seeking an agreement by year end, and the OECD will provide the must provide the G20 with blueprints by October. So what do you think is going to happen over the next couple of weeks? I know Isabella has already talked about the blueprints, but can we expect that there will be blueprints and that we have something by year end or early next year? What is your expectation?
I think, Stefan, it's very difficult to call, as you can understand. From Pascal's words, you can really understand that it's also very uncertain for them whether there will be a meaningful agreement. But what I think is happening now is that there is a really big effort from the OECD and the member countries, the OECD officials, the secretariat, to get the blueprints ready, which means getting the technical details ready. Okay. And this goes back to what Isabel was saying before. Even if there is no political agreement, the technical work will crystallize quickly. Okay, we'll crystallize it in the next couple of months, 2-3 months. And then we hope there will be a consultation where, and Pascal was quite clear yesterday saying that there will be room for, you know, input from various stakeholders. And I really hope there will be real room for that, because this is a pillar one and two are such a structural change to the corporate tax system, such a big change that no one can do this alone. Okay, so I really hope that we will be able to input on the technical details of both pillar one and pillar two. And, you know, from the political perspective, I think that every observer would agree that it's difficult to think of an agreement or a meaningful agreement before the US elections in November this year. But even if you think of a new administration, assume Joe Biden is elected, it's unsure whether the US will agree on especially Pillar 1. If you think back, the Obama administration wasn't particularly engaged at the OECD. And in any case, it takes time for the new appointed officials to understand what they are agreeing to. So maybe, you know, the agreement will be pushed, if there is one, to quarter one, quarter two of 2021. But it's very difficult to call. And from Pascal's words yesterday, it was very clear it's very difficult to call for them too.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Georgia. I know that was a tricky one. So I think we tried to cover everything in a couple of minutes. What has happened over the last weeks? We see the US trying to push the pause button on pillar one. We see that OECD is working on it. And I'm citing another thing from Pascal when he was saying, we keep working, we're alive, we are not on life support in dealing with pillar one and pillar two. So obviously there's something going on. Whenever it's coming across, whether it's first quarter or second quarter next year, I think that does not really change everything. I'm fully with you, George, and I think these are the perfect last words. Pillar one and pillar two will have a kind of, or will lead to a dramatic change in international taxation. So I'm with you to say we do hope there will be a public consultation where everything is put on the agenda, is discussed in the context of the US developments, of course. But I think that is what we're going to see. So with that, I would say thank you very much, Isabel and Georgia, for being with me and for sharing your expertise and what you've heard and what you're seeing in the market. We hope that was helpful for you. And I think we will be back on this topic again once we know more, sometime between October and end of the year, I guess. For now, thank you very much and stay safe.
Thank you.
Thank you.